This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we go inside an ongoing battle over the separation of church and state in the U.S. military.
Our guest, Mikey Weinstein, founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, has spent decades challenging the influence of extremist evangelical fundamentalism in the armed forces.
We also speak with Mickey Huff from Project Censored about the state of investigative journalism.
As misinformation rises and trust in the press erodes, he makes a sharp case for why we need more muckrakers challenging power and what it will take to rebuild a media system that actually serves the public. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary and an evangelical Christian himself, has explicitly framed the Iran war through the lens of his religious faith, weaving scripture into his remarks, praying for, quote, overwhelming violence, unquote, against his enemies, and insisting that God stands with the U.S. against Iran, a Muslim-majority nation of some 90 million people. The ex-Fox News host has long worn his faith on his sleeve, literally and on his flesh. He has a large Jerusalem cross tattooed on his chest, and the words Deus Vult, a rallying cry used by the Crusaders, which means God wills it, is inked on his arm. In his 2020 book, American Crusade, Hegseth rejected the principle of separation of church and state and called it a leftist folklore. At a prayer breakfast on February 6th of this year, he said that the U.S., quote, remains a Christian nation in our DNA, if you can keep it, unquote. Hegseth told CBS News on March 6, quote, the providence of our Almighty God is there protecting those troops, unquote. When asked if he views the conflict in a religious context, Hegseth responded, quote, I'm a man of faith who encourages our troops to lean into their faith, unquote. During a press briefing on the war 4 days later, he quoted Psalm 144, stating, quote, blessed be the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, unquote. Last week, while hosting a Pentagon prayer service, Hegseth implored God to, quote, let every round find its mark against the enemies of righteousness and our great nation, unquote. And he asked that, quote, wicked souls be delivered to eternal damnation prepared for them, unquote. To help us understand what's going on and why it's a dangerous threat to our Constitution and our democracy, we're very pleased to be joined on Law and Disorder by Mikey Weinstein, who has been described by Harper's Magazine as, quote, the constitutional conscience of the U.S. military, a man determined to force accountability, unquote. Mikey's family has a long and distinguished U.S. military history, spanning three consecutive generations of military academy graduates and over 130 years of combined active duty military service. Mikey is a lawyer and a 1977 honor graduate of the United States Air Force Academy. A registered Republican, Mikey spent over 3 years working for the Reagan administration as legal counsel in the White House. In 2006, he founded the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, MRFF, to battle the influence of far-right, militant, radical, evangelical, religious fundamentalists in the U.S. military. He's the author of two books, With God on Our Side, One Man's War Against an Evangelical Coup in America's Military, and No Snowflake in an Avalanche, The Military Religious Freedom Foundation, Its Battle to Defend the Constitution, and One Family's Courageous War Against Religious Extremism in High Places. In 2011, Americans United for Separation of Church and State presented Mikey with UA's first ever Person of the Year Award, calling him, quote, the leading voice protecting church-state separation in the military. In December 2012, Defense News named Mikey one of the 100 most influential people in the U.S. defense. He was also named one of the 50 most influential Jews in America by Forward, one of the nation's preeminent Jewish publications. Not unexpectedly, Mikey has been reviled by the radical fundamentalist Christian far right, which has called him Satan, Satan's lawyer, the Antichrist, that godless secular leftist, antagonizer of all Christians, most dangerous man in America, and field general of the godless armies of Satan. Mikey Weinstein, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much, Steve and Heidi. I'd forgotten some of those things, so it's very, very nice to be here on this this broadcast. It's an honor and a privilege, and I want to thank you guys for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. In a recent news story, you described Hegseth's call to turn Iran into a religious war as, quote, completely, totally unprecedented. You said that he is making it clear that this is Jesus versus Mohammed. Please tell our listeners more about Hegseth's recent efforts to intrude religion into the American military. And what else has he done since Trump appointed him to Christianize the Department of Defense?
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure where to begin. I mean, Hegseth should be immediately impeached and should be facing criminal prosecution. He's a war criminal. I also want to tell people that are listening to this show, let's get in a hot air balloon and go up to 50,000 feet and look down at our species. Homo sapiens are a very new species on this planet, Steve and Heidi. I mean, we've been here maybe 200,000, arguably 250,000 years, and civilization is much, much newer than that. Maybe 6,000, 7,000, or 8,000 years if you go back to the Babylonians. We're barely getting any of this right. But I can tell you one thing, past is prologue. And in the past of our history, to the extent we know anything about it, whenever a radicalized extremist version of any religious faith has become joined at the hip with that part of the state that makes war, why, we do not end up with little babbling brooks or streams or creeks or even lakes or ponds. We end up with one thing, oceans and oceans of blood. It's not just the eight crusades, Heidi and Steve, from the 11th to the 13th century, or the Inquisition or the pogroms or the Holocaust. But whenever this has happened, this is where we end up. We have a constitutional representative republic in this country. We made our constitutional framers look at European history as we celebrate our 250 years this year. And they realized that most of the bloodbaths there had been when men of the cloth had been men in political power. They didn't stop there. They looked at Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell in England. And then they realized they didn't even have to leave our shores. They looked at the Salem witch trials and they said, not here. So they deliberately and intentionally and unequivocally, incontrovertibly cleaved a grand canyon between spiritual and temporal church and state in this country. What fuels MAGA is one thing, Christian nationalism. And if you guys don't know what that is an unbelievably orthodox conservative version of Christianity, a tortured, twisted version that is completely incompatible with our current democratic secular republic. It's the best way to describe it, if any of you are familiar with Margaret Atwood's best-selling books, The Handmaid's Tale, or the Hulu TV series that followed it, it shows America fallen in the near dystopian future to a hellscape of Christian nationalist control. The new country is called Gilead, and that's where we are. As we do this broadcast today, let me make it clear to you listeners, we're not in a vehicle driving to the abyss. We haven't parked in the adjacent parking lot staring into the abyss. We are in the abyss, and we are heading to this oceans and oceans of blood. Everything you described from Hegseth, with what's on his right arm, what's on his chest, the idea that he wants members of the military to lean into their faith. No, he doesn't. He wants them to accept only his faith. He has created a template for the approved solution to be a sailor, soldier, marine, airman, or guardian. By the way, that's what they're called in the U.S. Space Force, which is part of the Air Force, the way the Marines are part of the Navy. They're called guardians, like the Cleveland Major League Baseball team. The template is to be four things and four things only: straight, white, Christian nationalist, and male. Anything other than that is not approved. And that's why you're seeing the firings occurring at the highest levels of the Pentagon. One of the first things Hegseth did when he took over the Pentagon was to fire the three T-JAGs. What is a T-JAG, you ask? That stands as T-J-A-G. It stands for the Judge Advocate General. That's the highest general in the military lawyers corps. I was in the Air Force JAG Corps myself for 7 years after I graduated from the Air Force Academy. These are three-star generals, lieutenant generals. They were immediately fired. And the message is out is that you either toe the line or you're going to be out. When he called all the flag officers to Quantico in September of last year, 2024, for a mandatory meeting. All flag officers means admirals and generals and the most senior enlisted folks in each command. There were 838 people in that room in Quantico. Of course, Trump stopped by for adulation. We had 17 of our clients there. We represent over 100,000 active duty, National Guard and Reserve, and veteran members of the military. About 95% of our clients are Christians that are being tortured and abused for not being Christian enough. So let me make it very clear. The last thing I'll tell you is this. When we started in the early 2000s, we've been out about a year and a half. I don't think we had 2,000 clients. When guess what? I got a call one day from Tokyo, Japan. I think about this every hour of every day, Steve and Heidi. The person on the phone said they were an executive with the Kyoto News Service, which is like the Associated Press, apparently, for the far East. They're huge. He asked if he could send a journalist all the way from Tokyo to where I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to do an interview. And I said, well, why? They said, well, we want to do a profile on you. We're watching what you're doing. And again, maybe we had 2,000 clients, but out of 18 months. So I said, well, sure, we could do it by telephone. He goes, no, we want to send them all the way if you'll accept him. And I said, well, why is he coming here? And he said, if you'll accept the journalist, he will explain that before the interview starts. So I agreed. Next week and a half later, at my front door is this impeccably dressed a gentleman from the Kyoto News Service. He graduated from Tokyo University, which is like their version of Harvard, spoke immaculate English. We sat down and he said, before we start, by the way, we did a 4-hour interview. He said, before we start, you probably want to know what I'm doing here, Mr. Weinstein. So I said, yes. He goes, let me tell you what the answer to that question is. In 1936, our Imperial Japanese military invaded Manchuria. 5 years later, on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, we bombed your Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Not long after, the only two times atomic weapons have been used in anger were dropped by the United States to destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, we did those things because our Imperial Japanese military became infused with radicalized fundamentalist Shintoism. We learned our lesson. Now, we're watching what you're fighting now in America. Mind you, this was 20 years ago. You're not fighting radicalized Shintoism. You're fighting radicalized Christianity. And frankly, we're scared. Well, I think about that every day because we're fighting the most radical version of Christianity extant. It is the Christian version of the Wahhabist and Salafist versions of Islam that you see with Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, ISIS, and the Taliban. And either Americans are going to stand up and do something about it, they're going to either resist or they're collaborating. And if you're doing neither, let me make it clear to the listeners of this program. If you're only sitting around circulating blood, reflecting light, and breathing, you're collaborating. I realize the year is 2026. However, it feels like 1933 Nazi Germany. I lost enough members of my family in the Holocaust that I understand what that means. And I might be still a registered Republican. I haven't found one I can vote for the last 3+ decades. That's my answer to the question.
Mikey, what Hegseth is doing may be unprecedented, but you've been challenging violations of separation of church and state in the military for over 20 years. Please tell our listeners why you took on this cause in the first place and how you've exposed the influence of far-right militant radical evangelical religious fundamentalists in the U.S. military.
That's a great question, Heidi. Basically, my wife and I started off as tough parents. We had three of our kids at the Air Force Academy in 2004. And then I really owed this all to Mel Gibson, because he came out with that great family movie, The Passion of the Christ, or as we refer to it here at the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and you can check this out at mrff.org. We refer to that movie as the Jesus Chainsaw Massacre or Freddy versus Jesus. Like most of Mel Gibson's movies, some of them are, I actually enjoy myself. They're pretty bloody, like, you know, Braveheart and Apocalypto. But this movie was off the scale with regard to the beating, the absolute, you know, punishing of Christ at his crucifixion. My kids were being forced by their officer and cadet chains of command at my alma mater to go see that damn thing. The entire cadet wing was. They were being forced to go see it. So there was very little that they could fight back with. And of course, I was at that time held in high repute because I'd been a member of the, was a lawyer for Reagan in the White House. I was general counsel for H. Ross Perot himself, who had run twice for the presidency and was a classmate of my father's and best friends at the Naval Academy. So I was held in high repute. I checked on this, like, why is this happening? As the cadets marched into their to Mitchell Hall, where they have their mandatory meals, every plate had a flyer pushing to go see this movie. As they went into Fairchild Hall, the academic building, all of the walls were Fairchild Hall, the academic building, were completely papered with these flyers. And the pressure by their chain of command to go see this was completely off the scale. Let me remind your listeners, many of whom may not understand the peculiarly adversarial, communal, ritualistic, and tribal nature of the military, that your military superior is not your shift supervisor at Starbucks or your boss at IBM. They have complete and total control over your lives. If you're even being gently evangelized by your military superior, get the hell out of my face, sir or ma'am, is not an option for you. So they come to us, and we are admittedly a militant and aggressive civil rights organization, but our militancy and aggression is always legal, ethical, and moral, and it's in support of the constitutional foundational apparatus to separate church and state. So I realized there was nobody else that could do this. A member of the military can't just call the ACLU or Americans United or other organizations and have somebody answer 24/7 or 25/8 around the clock, 365, 366 in leap years. So the more we pulled on this little thread that we found, the whole sweater fell off, and we found out that it wasn't just my alma mater, the Air Force Academy, that was systemic with a pervasive and pernicious pattern and practice of Christian fundamentalism, inextricably intertwined into the very DNA of the essence of our military. You know, it was throughout the Department of Defense, or the Pentecostal gun, as we referred to it. So that's where we've been. That's where we stay. We're very proud of the fact that we have 8 Nobel Peace Prize nominations. And the last 5 nominations came from a prior winner of the Peace Prize, one of whom is on our board.
Mikey, your organization, Military Religious Freedom Foundation, has filed lawsuits and amicus friend of the court briefs in a wide array of cases, and you've alluded to this already. Please tell us about the major cases and what you've been able to achieve in court to defend separation of church and state.
Yes, let me make it clear. In court, it's very difficult in the military because you need a plaintiff. And if you out yourself in the military standing up for your rights, you turn yourself into what we call here a tarantula on a wedding cake. I'm sure all of your listeners have been to weddings, and they know that if that happens, it's not good for the tarantula or the wedding cake. Unless we're able to get John or Jane Doe protection, it's very, very difficult to go into court to get something. We're currently suing the VA and the Air Force Academy again. But the more effective way to get the military, the better type of kryptonite, if you will, for Superman, is exposure in the media, which is exactly what we're doing on Law and Disorder right now. The military can't stand bad press. Some of our biggest stories have been, and you can Google these, Jesus nukes and Jesus rifles. It turns out that every rifle in the American military, we had 138 Marines, U.S. Marines and soldiers who were fighting in one of the bloodiest areas of Afghanistan, Helmand Province, come to us because their rifles had inscribed on the metal cases holding the scopes. I know it sounds unbelievable. Biblical citations from the synoptic gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the solo non-synoptic gospel of John, as well as the book of Revelation. And of course, they were trying to scratch them off because the villagers, remember, 90% of Afghanistan was illiterate and is illiterate, and they didn't even know what we were doing. They hadn't even heard of 9/11. But the village elders wanted to see what we call the Jesus rifles. And you understand the optics of aiming at Muslims and you're shooting them through these scopes that have that these biblical citations on them. Well, it turns out that Trigicon Corporation in northern Michigan had won a $2 billion contract from the Pentagon to make these scopes. And they decided, much like if you think In-N-Out Burger does that, Hobby Lobby does it, Chick-fil-A, but those are private companies. And they're not working with the U.S. government, but they put these on their scopes. And General Petraeus at the time denied it happened, and that lasted for 24 hours. Then he had to admit, okay, yeah, it's there. But it wasn't just there. All of NATO's rifles had the same thing. And one step further, the Israeli Defense Forces rifles also had them. These scopes that Trigicon makes are great, but they're trying to proselytize as best they can. We stopped it. They're changing the rifles. They had to send them all back and get them fixed. Jesus nukes. We had 68. That's right, 68 nuclear missile launch officers in the state of California at Vandenberg Air Force Base, where I went to high school, come to us because they were being indoctrinated with a PowerPoint presentation, making it clear that was filled. We got it under the Freedom of Information Act, and we exposed it to the world. It's on our website, filled with biblical references as to why Jesus loves the idea of launching nuclear weapons. And finally, they had an endorsement and validation from an SS scientist named Werner von Braun, saying that the best Nazis wanted to take German rocket technology at the end of World War II, get this, to a Bible-based society, which is why they brought it to America. It turns out the Air Force, they've been using it for 35 years. The Air Force admitted to 25 years, and they stopped it immediately. But most of the time, what we do is when we have a complainant that comes to us, we provide our clients AARP, and not the one you're thinking about, but anonymity, action, results, and protection. Our clients don't want anything to hit the media at all. We generally go two levels above the fundamentalist Christian nationalist that's offending them. And we go to, you know, two levels above in the command section and make them realize that we're here and they better fix it or we're going to blow it up or do whatever we need to do. We're successful well over 95% of the time, but it's much like a weed whacker. Weeks, sometimes months later, it comes back again. And when you find Christian nationalism, Steve and Heidi, you know, in elementary schools, middle schools, I don't know, high schools, colleges, junior colleges, legislatures, among the public sewage workers, cops and firefighters, and even legislatures, it's bad. But when you find it in the technologically most lethal organization ever created by our species, Homo sapiens, it is not a problem, issue, or challenge. It is a national security threat to this country and the world that must be stopped if we're going to avoid the cataclysm of again, the oceans and oceans of blood. And let me give you guys a metric. Let me remind you of this. If you, the Christian nationalists are promised, and they are they love this metric with a degree of adulation that they obsess for it. At the Battle of Armageddon, they're promised a 200-mile-long river, 4.5 feet deep, filled with nothing but the human blood of those that their version of weaponized Jesus has slaughtered at that Battle of Armageddon.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. Today, we're interviewing Mickey Weinstein, the founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation.
Mikey, how does the intrusion of religion in the U.S. military fit into the larger movement to impose Christian nationalism in America generally?
It doesn't. That's another great question. It doesn't fit like a toolkit. It is the toolkit. What fuels MAGA is Christian nationalism. As Mein Kampf was to Hitler. Hitler wrote that book when he was in jail, you know, years before he rose to power. But MAGA did very much the same thing, but not years before. A few months before, they put out Project 2025, a 1,000-page document saying exactly what they were going to do, down to the particulate of a Schedule F and eliminating all of the senior civilians in the Pentagon, 70,000 throughout the government that would obstruct like they did in the first Trump administration. They spelled it out for everyone, but too many Americans are uneducated. Many Americans don't know there are three branches of government. We stopped teaching government in our high schools, you know, decades ago. They are too supine. They do not understand what is happening. They don't pay attention. And you talk about a magnitude of damage, Heidi. We cannot fix this, even with a full-throated blue response in November. Even if we take the House, the blue takes the House and the Senate. In fact, Trump will be, I'm sure, impeached again. And maybe this time, third time's a charm, he'll be found guilty. Do you think he's going to leave? I don't. I think that could spark a civil war. So what we're dealing with now, we're doing generational damage to our constitutional republic, and we're doing generational damage to our United States military.
Mikey, I'm going to share with our listeners that during this recording, I think we heard some dogs in the background. What toll has this work taken on you and your family? And what steps have you taken in order to keep up the campaign that you're leading?
We don't hide from this, and I'm not trying to play the violin saying, oh, poor pitiful us. I am a public figure. I didn't ask to become one. But that's the nature of this business. We are, again, very passionate about what we do. If you're a Hollywood actor or a professional athlete, you know, I'm sure that being a public figure can be cool. If you do what I do, it isn't cool. It's lonely, dangerous, brutal, and expensive. We've had the window shot out of our house twice. We've had innocent animals beheaded and disemboweled and left on the front of the house. Mind you, we live in a blue state, in a blue city, in a very blue, nice neighborhood. We've had swastikas and crucifixes painted on our house, beer bottles and feces thrown at the house, feces smeared on the mailbox, tires slashed. We average between 12 to 18 fairly grotesque threats, almost all of them anti-Semitic, on a daily basis. The latest thing that we're working on is a threat that came in several weeks ago, putting $20,000 as a bounty to murder me and $5,000 for each of our staff members. We took it seriously because that's not that much money. And so we work very closely with our local law enforcement. We have our own bodyguards. We love our German Shepherds, but they are not pets. They are elite level protection, defense, and attack dogs. We have concealed carry weapons with us everywhere. I'm about 5 inches away from a 38 Smith & Wesson Special with a laser sight on it right now. We have many weapons in the house. We're trained on them. We have to have professional bodyguards with us. We sit a certain way in a restaurant. We sit a certain way at a ball game. We sit a certain way in a movie theater. Again, we've had attacks at the house, and we get the threats just almost on an hourly basis. So we will take the heat. Our clients don't have, they're doing enough serving the nation. My wife also has a disease known as MS. One of the triggers for that is stress, you know, and she's the one that maintains the liaison between our German Shepherds and our local law enforcement. They train every 7 days together. We're about as careful as we can be. Anyone who goes to the website, you can check out the hate link. My wife has written 2 books with our LA-based publishers just with the hate mail that we get. As an example, that we have groups praying for all the female litigators associated with us to develop fast-moving metastasizing breast cancer. We've had people threaten to come to the house to cut off my head, collect my blood in the bathtub, and then rape my wife as they drown her in there. I've got 4 kids and 3 grandkids. One of my kids is a Democratic state senator in Ohio. They catch it all the time as well. So we just deal with it. I'm not showing it as a badge of courage. I'm just saying we're not going to go away. And I think one more thing. I think in this life, Heidi and Steve, we are better defined by who hates us than by who likes us. And to that extent, we're very proud of the fact that in the summer of 2023, the MAGA members of the U.S. House of Representatives and Congress tried to do the unthinkable. In an unprecedented manner, they amended the largest part of the federal budget. They actually amended it. The National Defense Authorization Act, commonly referred to as the Pentagon Funding Bill, to make it a felony under the Uniform Code of Military Justice for any member of the military to reach out to us for help. We were in there by name three times. We had to work for 6 months with the Democrats on the Senate side at the last minute to get that out in conference before one of the last things Biden saw. They never even have done that to the ACLU or to Planned Parenthood. So we use that as a badge of courage. But this is a full contact sport, and you've got to be prepared to die to do this. I don't want to die. We've hardened ourselves as much as we can. We have a very intricate system of infrared cameras all over the house and outside of on the property. Some of them are disguised, and they pipe right into our law enforcement department. That's how life is.
Mikey, how can our listeners learn more about the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and what can they do to combat Christian nationalism in the U.S. in general, and in the military in particular?
Another good question. If you want to find out anything about us, just go to our website. The URL is simple. It's mrff.org. Obviously, that stands for Military Religious Freedom Foundation. But if you can't remember that, just think of Mr. Firefighter, mrff.org. If you want to talk to me, I'm unusual in that I will answer my phone at all times because we're here for our clients. We have over 1,200 people that work here, paid and volunteer. We have MRFF reps around the world on even nuclear submarines and nuclear aircraft carriers. My phone number, it's on the record, is personal. You call me, I'll answer. 505-250-7727. You got to stand up because at some point, whether you have kids or grandkids, if we ever get back again, and we may not, we may have crossed too many Rubicons, but if we ever get back, have an answer for your great-grandkids, your grandkids, your kids as to mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, what did you do to fight this? Stand up. Donate to organizations like ours and others that are out there. You don't have to put your face on the line like we do, but we're fighting this stuff. And I want to say something that follows on what Hegseth said. When Dr. Benjamin Franklin left the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia after we finally had a constitution, many people know about this. He was the rock star of his day. He walked out and the American colonists said, Dr. Franklin, what have you all bequeathed to us in this constitution? His response was, a republic, if you can keep it. Please help the Military Religious Freedom Foundation and the rest of America keep this beautiful Democratic Republic. We're not perfect, but we're worth keeping.
Mikey Weinstein, thank you not only for joining us today on Law and Disorder, but for literally everything you do every day. Be safe and good luck.
Again, I really appreciate the honor, privilege, and opportunity. Best to you all. Thank you. Hope you stay on the air forever.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
There was a time when journalism didn't just report the news, it changed the country. It broke monopolies, exposed corruption, and even forced presidents to take action. Today, with public trust in the media at historic lows, that kind of reporting can feel like a relic. But what if the real story isn't that it's gone, but that we've stopped supporting it? Media scholar and activist Mickey Huff has just written a provocative call to action called We Need More Muckrakers and Fewer Bucktakers. It's a phrase rooted in the legacy of Carl Jensen, who believed that journalism should serve the public, not profits, and who spent decades exposing the stories that corporate media ignored. At a moment when misinformation spreads faster than truth, and corporate consolidation shapes what we see and what we don't see, this conversation asks something deeper. What kind of media system does democracy require, and what role do we play in rebuilding that? Mickey Huff is the director of Project Censored and president of the Media Freedom Foundation, where he has co-edited its annual Censored book series since 2009. In 2024, he joined Ithaca College as a professor of journalism and the distinguished director of the Park Center for Independent Media. Through these roles, he leads efforts in critical media literacy, independent journalism, and the production of the weekly syndicated Project Censored show. Mickey, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Heidi and Steve, it is my pleasure to be here with you today. Big fan of the program and the topics that you cover. So again, I'm delighted to be here with you for this segment to talk about the importance of critical news media literacy and muckraking journalism in the public interest.
Mickey, you open your recent dispatch with this striking call, quote, more muckrakers and fewer bucktakers. What does that mean in today's media landscape?
Well, Carl Jensen founded Project Censored in 1976, and he started it as a student research project in the wake of Watergate to look at what independent journalism covered that the corporate media maybe missed or took too long to get to make a significant difference societally. And part of that critique, which was constructive, by the way, he gained accolades from, you know, I.F. Izzy Stone and Walter Cronkite, Hugh Downs, you know, contemporaries, and certainly the latter of those two were in the establishment press, you know, and Izzy left and started his own. So Carl kind of was trying to cover all the bases. And one of the things that he really looked at, he didn't just look at corporate media and profit taking and the structure of establishment media as the problem. He also wondered what was happening in journalism programs and how were people being taught to do journalism in a media landscape that was increasingly corporate, hyper commercial, run for profit, and what did that do to the public interest? And so in one of his more pithy with a TH lines, he really encouraged journalism programs and colleges across the country to turn out more muckrakers and fewer buck takers, meaning get into journalism for what it means and why it's important. It's not just a job. It's a calling. It's a civic duty to be able to write, report, and share information about what's going on in our society so people can be more meaningfully engaged. And while Carl certainly wasn't begrudging people making a living by being journalists writing in the public interest, he was just simply saying that the commercial nature of media was infecting journalism in a way that really was changing what was being covered, how it was being talked about, and also sometimes things that just wouldn't be covered at all because of financial conflicts of interest between owners or advertisers or reliance on elite sourcing and so forth. So that's kind of what it's at the root of that statement. And I have to say, Heidi and Steve, it's truer now than ever. We really do need more muckrakers and fewer buck takers. You know, the buck takers have taken all the money and they've bought up the billionaire press. It's hard for people to find truthful and accurate information across the establishment media and the corporate media because they've got these built-in conflicts about profiteering. The independent media, by contrast, isn't necessarily, quote, objective. Nothing is, important to note. But it tends to wear its bias on its sleeve, and it tends to be more interested in reporting about the key issues of the day. And so that's why at the project, we highlight the most important independent stories that are covered each year that the corporate media either miss or distort. And I also do the same at the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where we have the honor of giving what's known as the Izzy Award every year. This will be the 18th Izzy coming up April 21st and 22nd for Izzy Fest at Ithaca College that celebrates the importance of independent media, sort of in the vein of the muckraking of Izzy Stone.
Mickey, it's such a pleasure to meet you by this interview. I have followed the work of Project Censored virtually from its founding. Hearing you today, you almost might accuse the general media of being buck passers as well as buck takers. You argue that journalism is the lifeblood of democracy. What happens to a democracy when that lifeblood is weakened?
Well, what happens is the body politic weakens with it. The civic sphere goes with it, the public sphere. It's just like what would happen in our own body. The health of the overall state is connected. The health of society is, in my view, connected to that how free and flowing the kind of information that the public really needs is. How available is it? How free flowing is the information? Steve, you just said a great thing, and I'm gonna steal that with attribution, of course. But buck passing is exactly what a lot of the corporate media do. If the story is too hot or too controversial, they might give one line to it, or they'll both sides a topic to say they covered it, but then they'll move on to something more titillating, or they'll tabloidize it, or they'll go back to something else that's, you know, again, more sensational, more grabbing eyeballs for advertisers. The independent press doesn't do that. The independent press goes where the story takes us, right? And it often focuses on subjects that are of great importance to the public. But take, for example, there's been an uptick in stories about resistance to things like AI, artificial intelligence, data centers, but that was being reported in the independent media for quite some time. It's only been recently that the corporate media have begun to address some of the pushback against AI data centers, and they always like to talk about, well, these people just don't know, and this is a bunch of Luddites, and that's not what this issue is about at all. And so that's a current example of how, for a while, the corporate media will ignore something, then it'll come up in the independent press enough that they can't really seem to ignore it anymore, but then they kind of put their stamp on it or their spin, and then, as you suggested, they'll pass the buck down, they'll change the subject, they'll move along, and they'll act like, well, we covered AI data centers, what's next? Not realizing that stories sometimes have a very long foundation historical beginning, they have a long development process, and they persist into the future, whether or not the corporate press covers those topics or not. The independent press tends to stay with the stories in the public interest and tends to build trust by this life's blood force, right? By creating with better information, more accurate information. As George Seldes said in the 20th century, the job of journalism isn't to be objective or balanced or both sides. The job of good journalism is to be in the public interest and tell the people what's really going on transparently, based on the facts, following the code of ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists. And that's what we need more of. And I think that the cratering public trust in the media would reverse. We could start to build trust again if the major outlets would begin doing more reporting. I'm not saying they don't do any, but if they would do it more often in the public interest, and they would really earn the trust of the public, and they would do that by being muckrakers, not buck takers or buck passers.
Mickey, let's talk for a minute about the so-called golden age of muckraking. What made that era so powerful?
Well, Heidi, I don't want to have antiquity fallacy going on here, or the rose-colored glasses, per se. It's not that, things were so much better. But in this case, there was a better example of muckraking journalism that contributed to meaningful societal reforms or changes. And that's one of the things we can get to maybe later in the conversation. It's not that we don't have reporting going on like this now. There's all kinds of independent media outlets that are reporting about really important things, long-form investigative reporting, different formats, documentaries, podcasting. So it's there. But without critical media literacy education and expanding news diets, people can't always find it, right? That's the one advantage that the establishment press have. And you'll notice I don't call it the mainstream media like most people do. That's because there's nothing mainstream about a half a dozen corporations and seven billionaires that basically control most of the media people hear, read, see, etc. That's why we use terms like corporate media, big tech, right? Silicon Valley media. We use these adjectives because they help people understand what the possible biases could be. Muckraking then goes back to the early part of the 20th century. I mean, it goes back further than that, end of the 19th century. If you take a look at Ida Tarbell, who took on John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil in the pages of McClure's, Lincoln Steffens is another example. His Shame of the City series exposed municipal corruption. Of course, most people are familiar with people like Upton Sinclair, uncovering public health hazards in the meatpacking industry, for example. Those all led to changes. Those led to meaningful reforms. And interestingly enough, Teddy Roosevelt, the president at the time, initially championed the notion of muckraking journalism, and that actually helped fuel some of his progressive era legislation, including it was, in fact, his personal physician who read Sinclair's The Jungle, and Roosevelt fancied himself a great outdoor enthusiast and conservationist, which led him to passing conservation laws and these kinds of things. But it also freaked him out when he was told about the problems in the industrial food production system, and it led him to pass the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906. This is a meaningful change. This is exactly how the Fourth Estate should be working, and this is why the founders protected it, is so that the government couldn't interfere with it. Unfortunately, censorship by proxy allows corporate owners to interfere with it all the time. And that's not to say that government doesn't interfere. We're seeing great examples of that just in the last 15 months of the government really violating the First Amendment in many ways, including with the FCC threatening media, threatening to take people off air, etc., withholding licenses and so forth. But Roosevelt had a change of heart, and it was about politics. And so specifically, Steffens' reporting was very particular about politics, but it was David Graham Phillips writing the Cosmopolitan series, The Treason of the Senate, that really changed Roosevelt's perspective in a lot of ways, because in that series, it criticized people in Congress that Roosevelt needed to pass his legislation. And so Roosevelt decided that well, sure, I might have said this was good before, but it goes too far. And so he looked back at Pilgrim's Progress, you know, going back to John Bunyan in 1678, the story of the muckrake who could look no way but downward. And what Roosevelt was suggesting was that journalists had become, quote, muckrakers in a way that all they did was clean up the filth and look at dirt, right? They just saw the bad and everything, and they didn't see the affirmative. And that's not really true. I mean, if you go back and take a look and really read those folks, they did offer compromises. They offered solutions. Some of these folks that were doing this kind of journalism were actually socialists or in labor unions, and they thought that there were vehicles to change society and make it more just and equitable for people. It's unfortunate that Roosevelt turned that into a negative term, you know, and some of the journalists actually caught on, and they thought it was an insult right? They did. They thought like Ida Tarbell, you know, thinks that this is an insult. But Steffens and Sinclair thought it was a badge of honor. Many others thought it was a badge of honor. Today, when we use the term muckraking journalism, and as I used it in the title, I'm looking at it as an honorific. It's something that I think is built in to journalism, that if you're doing it right, that's partly what you're doing. And you're not just breaking the muck. You're looking for solutions, and you're trying to tell the public what's really going on to make positive changes.
Mickey, do you think journalism today still has the ability to force change, or has something fundamentally shifted in American society?
Steve, that's an extraordinary question, and it's I have a mixed response on this, because I do think that contemporary journalism, including the establishment media, has the ability to make important changes, but they have a lot of work to do to earn back the trust of the public that they've lost over the last decade plus. It's been waning in the 21st century, but especially in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been just lowering, lowering, and lowering. I think that something has shifted, because nowadays we are seeing what happens when the buck takers win out and the muckrakers are shelved. We just saw an example of that even at CBS, which they're one of their great programs, news magazine programs, 60 Minutes, that often did really good in-depth exposés, certainly great reporting in the corporate media, right? That was an example of a pretty well-done show in the public interest. The Ellisons bought it. They put in Barry Weiss from The Free Press, not to be confused with our friends at freepress.net. And they've basically been cleaning house of anybody with a muckraking bone in their body. Again, if corporations are going to continue to change journalism and move it into the infotainment sector, or if they're going to kowtow to the hyperpartisan culture like Fox or MS Now, then you know that force for change, I think, is mitigated, because it becomes a siloed affair where they're preaching to the converted or preaching to the choir. And look, that's not a bad thing to do sometimes. I know the independent press gets accused of doing that too, right? Because they have a bias. People on the left maybe read Jacobin or The Nation, and they know what they're getting when they go there. But the difference is, too, is I think that the reporters that are working in some of the independent media, they really do want to cause changes. They want to change. They're not writing just to inform the public. They're writing because they know that an informed public can make better decisions about the things that are happening around them and be more meaningfully civically engaged. Whereas in the corporate media, even though those might be slogans and mantras, it sometimes feels like they're so disconnected from everyday Americans that they're mostly really only reporting to themselves in an elite class. You know, I think a lot of the broadcast and cable networks are geared for about 20% of the population, and then everybody else is just kind of slid in as an afterthought at best, if ever. Some groups are totally ignored and marginalized. That's why, you know, I won't say turn off the corporate media, although that's fun to say, but I would say people need to really expand their media diets. I think it's important to watch the corporate media to find out what the establishment line is, what the status quo is, what they're trying to get people to believe. And the independent press is great because it shines a light on some of the lies and misstatements and mis and disinformation, and it exposes sometimes otherwise straightforward reporting as the propaganda it is when we put our critical thinking hats on.
Mickey, let's talk about the decline of muckraking briefly. I know that after major news moments like the Watergate scandal, muckraking declined. Why didn't the momentum even from that event endure?
Heidi, that's a brilliant question. And it seems to me that as muckraking journalism gradually became more popular, you know, that's why it was filling the pages of McClure's and Cosmopolitan. They were selling papers, right? But copycat. Other outlets started to see that those kind of stories were selling papers, and so it led to the rise of what we refer to often as yellow journalism, which referred to the color of the paper. It was a cheaper kind of paper. They could print a lot of it, and they wanted more muckraking stories faster. The problem with that is you can't rush investigative journalism. It takes time. It takes intelligence. It takes questioning. It takes courage. It takes resources. I could go on. But you know, the demand for it was outpacing the ability to produce it. And so it turned into more tabloidized reporting. I'm not going to say Steffens and Sinclair participated in that, you know, or Ray Standerbaker or others, but the style began to be emulated in ways that were very sloppy, copies of it. So that's also why muckraking journalism became less popular, is because the stories became more tabloidized and less accurate. Even in a slower technological era versus today, the early 20th century was getting into the hustle bustle of American industry and the beginnings of what we call mass society. The public attention span, longer certainly than it is now, also waned, and people began to want the new thing every day in the morning news. Daniel Boorstin, the great historian in the 1960s, wrote a book called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, that actually talked a lot about that phenomenon, about our extraordinary expectations, right? And how it's kind of baked into the myth of American exceptionalism. And we kind of apply it glibly to everything. And if it's not fast, it's, you know, and not now, then we don't want it. And we now live in the, just, my goodness, some kind of, I can't even call it an apex of it. I mean, it seems like it's still going. Everything has to be faster. The whole mantra in Silicon Valley is move fast and break things. And that's not what investigative journalism does. It's not supposed to move fast and break things. It's supposed to move deliberately and accurately, and it's supposed to change things. And I think that those are key differences. And I think that we need more of that kind of journalism today. And I do believe that if what we call mainstream, the establishment press, I believe that if they would really return to telling stories in the public interest and really tell the public what's really going on, they could rebuild their subscriptions. They could rebuild their bases. And I think that they could rebuild trust. And that's probably the most important thing that is now missing from that establishment resource is public trust.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and along with my co-host Stephen Rohde, we're speaking with activist and media scholar Mickey Huff from Project Censored.
Mickey, in the midst of all this, how did policies like the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine and the Telecommunications Act of 1996 reshape the media landscape?
Steve, quite extraordinarily, Fairness Doctrine came out in 1949, post-World War II, part of the sort of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, the idea that people should be able to not only express themselves, but receive views and different views, right, so that we could create a more just and equitable world. And the Fairness Doctrine was reversed, taken away by the Reagan administration in 1987, and that predated the Clinton administration passing the second largest telecommunications law in U.S. history in 1996, which radically reshaped the media landscape because it allowed fewer corporations to own more media outlets in local markets. And so a combination of the Fairness Doctrine, which was something that mandated that you hear from multiple perspectives about important events and from elected officials, when that disappeared and the Telecom Act changed to allow for more monopolistic type ownership, it led to the rise of, you know, what AM radio, right-wing radio with Rush Limbaugh, and it led to the rise of Fox News with Roger Ailes, who was a communications person in the Reagan administration and Fox owned by Rupert Murdoch. The purpose was, they claimed, to counter the liberal bias of the establishment media. But that wasn't really a fair characterization. Yes, there's liberals in the press, but the idea that the whole media landscape was dominated by Democrats or liberals or socialists or Marxists or these kinds of things, a lot of folks throw around a lot of these terms nowadays as well to make them almost meaningless, render them meaningless. But that was just a cover. What they really wanted to do is become an adjunct of the Republican Party, and they wanted to have a mouthpiece for right-wing policies in this country that echo the Heritage Foundation, the Inter-American Enterprise Institute. They've been dreaming of doing this since the Nixon years, back when William Safire put the words "nattering nabobs of negativism" into Vice President Spiro Agnew's mouth. And that was a slight against the press, right? And Trump, of course, has echoed that, even, you know, calling the press the enemy of the people, echoing back to Nazi Germany and the Lügenpresse of World War I. So anyway, back to the story of the Fairness Doctrine and the Telecom Act. That Telecom Act really is on steroids now. We're seeing unprecedented media consolidation under the current FCC, Brendan Carr. It is not good for diversity of viewpoint. It has no interest in hearing from multiple perspectives. It is a hyper-partisan money machine and a propaganda bullhorn for the 1%. And that is what's happened to much of the news media and, of course, the entertainment media in this country. People love to talk about Hollywood liberals. They're not the ones that own these companies, and they're not the ones that are buying up the companies, and they're not the ones that are getting on these programs. Instead, we get an endless parade of corporate shills and retired military generals.
We're running out of our allotted time, unfortunately, but let's end on a positive note. Tell our listeners a bit about Project Censored's work that helps fill this void, and also if there are any other hopeful glimmers that you see on the horizon.
Absolutely, Heidi. Thanks so much for that. And thanks to you and Steve both for a great conversation today. I really appreciate it. You're obviously very knowledgeable about the topic, and that's why I'm going on and on about some of these things, and brevity isn't a strong suit of mine. But Project Censored, I think, is really part of the solution of some of the challenges that we were just talking about, because we highlight the significance of critical media literacy education. We're a student-based research project where students research the independent media to find these kind of stories that are missing in the corporate press. So we're not just providing these stories and platforming them and trying to get them, you know, more mileage on bigger platforms so that more people see and hear them. Of course, we are doing that. But we're also trying to teach people along the way how to broaden and diversify their media habits and be more critically media literate and be more mindful of the ways in which we get information, especially from sources like social media and, you know, algorithmic siloing and all the kind of things that go on now that make it harder to kind of break out of our own, you know, echo chambers. And so Project Censored, I think, does that by highlighting a lot of the diversity that's available in the independent media. And as I mentioned at the outset, there actually are quite a number of amazing independent media organizations around, whether it's Free Press, like I meant before, or other media, news groups, News Literacy Project, Critical Media Project at USC, etc. You know, there's quite a number of those kinds of projects, including the Park Center for Independent Media, where I direct at Ithaca College, that gives out the Izzy Award, that helps sponsors internships for students to get them working in independent media outlets that don't have a lot of budgets and money to pay people. So people need to just expand their news habits. They need to think critically about what's happening around them. They need to understand that there are many other people out there that are trying to make a difference. We have a chapter in our annual book called Media Democracy in Action that talks about great organizations and programs, including like this one, that are a real public service for trying to elevate public discourse and try, again, to educate people into being more meaningfully, civically engaged. And we really need to use these rights of expression and engagement, because those walls are closing in around us as we speak. And I'm not being hyperbolic. And I know you two know well what's going on right now and the real threats and challenges that the press face, and also we in general, we as citizens here in this country face. We need stronger independent journalism in the public interest for a stronger body politic and better, more responsive civic engagement. And so with that, I would say if your listeners are interested, they could go to projectcensored.org to learn more, or parkindymedia.org and get in touch with us. And if there's anything we can do for you, if you're an educator or anybody else out there that wants to learn more and get involved in any of our programs, we've got a lot of free curriculum and a lot of free educational materials online, and we often donate books to people in classrooms if they need it and they want to do this kind of education, or we can even travel or Zoom in to do workshops. And I just wanted to thank the both of you for everything that you do on Law and Disorder.
Well, Mickey, thank you so much for a really fact-filled half hour. We really appreciate the work that you and Project Censored continue to do after several decades. So we hope to have you on again and have a productive rest of the week.
Thanks so much, Heidi. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Steve.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder. And I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.